The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Folks, we're heading into a bright summer.
Inflation continued to heat up last month, with producer prices surging at their fastest year-over-year rate in at least a decade.
Record drought and sweltering heat are baking the western U.S. Palm Springs, California hit 120, a new record.
U.S. Federal Reserve officials on Wednesday said they expect to raise interest rates in 2023 sooner than their previous prediction of 2024.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Stock prices ending up on the downside this week. The market not liking the change in Fed wording. The increase in interest rates may come sooner than expected. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck will be Dan Wotropski. He still thinks this bull market has legs to run, even though we might get a possible correction in the short term. Also on the program will be Professor Silla, co-author of The History of Interest Rates. As we talk about interest rates where they are today, these huge deficits, and where they might go in the future. And finally, a interview with A. Gary Schilling as we talk about all the stimulus coming out of Washington. Well, it just may not happen. And then later on in the program, we'll be talking about some upcoming programs. I have one in particular I want you to listen, and that is my program on Monday when I talk to Dr. Peter McCullough on COVID, what to do if you get it. You're going to hear information you will not hear anyplace else that may just save your life. All that coming up on today's program, but first, let's go to Ryan Poplava to find out what moved the markets this week.
So today, I'm going to talk about the Fed talking about tapering bond purchases.
What you talking about?
And of course, it's been all the talk this week, and I'm sure there will be plenty more commentary in the months ahead to, you know, talk about. But from here on, this will likely be a phrase we hear less of since there is a clear change in tone at the Fed. The Federal Open Market Committee on Wednesday shifted from an ultra-accommodative tone to an accommodative tone. The emergency is behind us, and the unemployment and inflation objectives are on the trajectory now of meeting the Fed's goals. Enough that they can finally begin to warn us well in advance of any change they plan for the balance sheet and interest rates. And that's the case. This week, expectations were met. Wednesday, when the Fed left rates unchanged and the asset purchases were maintained at $120 billion pace per month. The Fed also reasserted that recent inflationary pressures are due to transitory factors, and Chairman Powell reiterated, as he has since April, that interest rate projections are not a good forecasting tool, that they are measuring actual progress to make these decisions. But here's the changes that did take place this week. The dot plot projections by the different voters and members of the Fed of where they think the economy is going and where they think rates are going, that rate hike could come possibly in 2023. Interest on excess reserves was increased to 0.15% from 0.10%, and the reverse repurchase rate was increased by 5 basis points to 5 basis points. So let's talk about the market reaction to the change in tone from the Fed. The S&P 500 fell as much as 1% after the news, but managed to rally for just a 0.5% loss on Wednesday. Now, the Fed Fund's sensitive 2-year Treasury yield went up 5 basis points to 0.21%. And the 10-year yield rose almost about 8 basis points to 1.57%. Finally, we saw a sizable increase in the U.S. dollar index, which rose 0.8%, and 10 of the 11 sectors in the S&P 500 were down, all except for consumer discretionary, which got a nice lift from Amazon and Tesla. Now, speaking about actual progress, the initial jobless claims report on Thursday showed an increase by about 37,000 to 412,000 when expectations were for a continued decline. On Thursday, this new short-term trend continued to develop from Wednesday with some real losses in the reflationary camp. Commodities were down, with copper and gold both down about 4.7%. Oil was down 1.4%, and the dollar up again, 0.9%. In stocks, the S&P 500 energy sector, following energy, was down 3.5%. Financials were down 2.9%. Materials down 2.2%. So reflationary really got kicked. And industrials were down 1.6%. On the other side of the coin, the NASDAQ climbed and gained 0.9%. Long-term yields fell, with the 10-year Treasury down as much as 12 basis points before settling down only 8 to 1.51%, while the 2-year Treasury rose again. That's key. You know, we've seen a little bit of a flattening of the yield curve, with the short end adjusting for inflationary expectations from the Fed of what the Fed plans to do with a taper around the corner, and the long end in agreement that inflation is transitory, with the added concern that companies have posted peak growth in earnings. It definitely didn't help that Citigroup warned that trading revenue would drop in the second quarter by 30% over last year's results. So long-term rates reversed course Thursday and Friday after the initial jump reaction to the Fed. Interestingly, one of the more dovish presidents of the Fed, James Bullard of the St. Louis Fed, suggested on Friday that due to high inflation, the Fed would need to hike actually next year. And that helped further invigorate some of the changes that we were seeing in the dollar, commodities, and stocks that already started to take place since that Wednesday Fed meeting. But to sum up the week in stocks, the S&P 500 value ETF, so a lot of cyclicals in there, a lot of interest rate sensitive companies, was down 4.16%. Interest rate sensitive financials, looking at the ETF XLF, was down 6.25%. Energy's XLE was down 5.4%. And then on the opposite side, the S&P 500 growth ETF, IVW, was only down 0.86%, along with the NASDAQ composite itself was only down 0.92%, showing that growth stocks and tech as a whole were buffered from the losses in cyclicals and materials and that reflationary story. Investors on the whole are agreeing with the Fed in how they trade stocks and bonds right now, that inflation is transitory despite the CPI levels and the PPI levels announced just last week. While long-term rates have fallen since April, they haven't fallen that much in comparison to the rate jump we've seen that even outsized the taper tantrum of 2013 just earlier this year. So to see a pullback after that, it's not out of the ordinary, and we call those counter-trend rallies. The interesting view will be just to watch how these markets react to continued trends of price increases of goods, which has been, like I said, the trend. Will that trend reverse, per the Fed's thinking? And is there something to these comments about peak growth? We'll want to see that next month as the earnings season starts, and next Friday we'll get some more inflationary data, or not, with the personal income and the PCE deflator to test which side is right on inflation, and more importantly, what story investors will side with. Thanks for listening to this week's wrap-up report. Jim, back to you. A shame, think something new
under sun. David, when we spoke to you last year, you had talked about four major trend changes that you were expecting to start this year. The first biggest trend that you said our listeners need to be aware of is going to be an increase in inflation. And as you and all of our listeners know, this is the biggest topic being discussed right now, is just the massive surge that we've seen in inflation.
The bottom line of it is that, yes, we were expecting this, especially as the pandemic ended. So this sort of synchronized global economic boom leading to massive price shifts, which would then unsettle financial markets, like you're saying.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. You waste all of your time covering up your tracks. Spend all your days running away. You got to watch your back.
Is your portfolio prepared for higher inflation? Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth.
Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the stock market's been pulling back over the last couple days after a Fed meeting saying they may start raising interest rates earlier than expected. Let's find out where this market's heading. Joining us from Janney Montgomery Scott is Dan Wobtrobski. And Dan, take it from the top. What does this look like? Consolidation, temporary pullback, or something serious?
Oh, boy, it's a great opening question. I mean, if you think about where we've come from over the last few months, we've actually been in consolidation for quite a while. Remember, we started 2021 in a massive recovery rally in U.S. equities and really at new all-time highs. But right around late February of this year, the NASDAQ and the tech sector got hit with a market peak, at least a temporary peak. And that index corrected by about 12% back in February. And since that time, actually, technology, really prior to today, has been trading in sort of a sideways trading range or consolidation, as you might say. Added to that, we then saw a correction in the magnitude of 9-10% in U.S. small caps. This hit after the tech sector correction in February and was really geared towards about mid-March. So you can see what's been happening here for a while underneath the surface. And despite the S&P 500 making new all-time highs, I believe even just yesterday or the day before, the broader markets have really experienced sort of this rolling consolidation or this rolling correction in time since about February. Now, with yesterday's change, you know, quote unquote, in posture from the FOMC, we're seeing a changing of the guard in sector leadership once again. And the NASDAQ, which corrected by about 12% back in February, is very close to breaking out to new all-time highs. In fact, we're watching the NASDAQ 100, which is large and mega cap tech, inching very close to breaking to new all-time highs and out of this consolidation cycle. And against that, we see what's underperforming, cyclicals, value, small caps. So it's almost like a mirror reversal. The first 6 months of this year was a reflationary recovery. You had a bull market in equities overall against rising interest rates. That pushed benchmarks like the S&P 500 to new all-time highs. It pushed small cap benchmarks like the S&P 600 into leadership position, up 23-24% year to date in some cases. And it pushed value as a great performer. It pushed banks and financials into pole position, up close to 30% for the first quarter of the year, maybe the first couple months of the year. And all during that time, tech was a notable underperformer, technology and the NASDAQ, relative underperformers. And then yesterday we saw the Fed's sort of new dot plot in which they are going to imply, you know, a couple of rate hikes prior to year end 2023. I believe what they've set the stage for in terms of their tone, their posturing, is that they believe inflationary pressures that we've seen are transitory, meaning temporary. But then beyond this transitory inflationary environment, we're going to settle into a more lower growth environment. So you got sort of the tail of two things here, because the long end of the treasury curve, especially with yields being pressed lower today, is telling us and is agreeing that on a longer term basis, we're not saddled with massive inflationary pressure. In fact, if anything, it is going to be that sort of lower growth environment. And again, what that's done is vaulted technology back into the lead on a relative basis. So the question is, in the days and weeks ahead, it will certainly determine whether or not this volatility we've seen over the last couple of days and sort of this rolling consolidation in the markets we've seen for the last couple of months, if it turns into something more sinister. In other words, a bigger correction for something like the S&P 500. What we've asked clients to watch at this point are some short-term support levels, which we think are important. If selling pressures escalate and sort of this risk-off mentality escalates because the street perceives we're moving into a slower growth environment rather than what the recovery rally has suggested thus far, I think this is going to be a very important level to watch for the remaining 6 months of the year. It's around 4050 to 4100 on the S&P 500, 4050 to 4100 on the S&P. When you look at the charts on this, it gives the impression of sort of a double bottom in the markets. And that's telling me that it is important support to watch. It also tells me that it gives us some bandwidth, right, for further correction, further volatility that really doesn't break the longer term trend. See, if the S&P holds above that level, 4,050, 4,100, it's our opinion that the longer term cycle, the longer term market trend remains intact. And this is, as you say, just the normal, you know, correction or consolidation period. If, however, we break that level, that sort of double bottom that I'm referring to, then we run the risk of, I think, a significant correction for something like the S&P. And I would think it would be in the magnitude anywhere 10, possibly 15% for the S&P. So it's we're watching things very closely. The long-term uptrend right now for the markets, the reflationary expansion cycle that we're watching is still intact. Nothing is broken yet, but things are getting a little bent. And again, the level to watch, 4050, 4100 on the S&P for bigger clues ahead.
It was amazing because this year you saw things like the Dow start to outperform the NASDAQ. We saw corrections in technology. You saw a takeoff in financials, energy, industrials, and materials, and those things are now receding.
Yeah, this is all about interest rates. I firmly believe this. There are intermarket correlations that really every investor has to watch. You can't just, you know, watch Apple or GameStop in a vacuum. Interest rates matter. And you can see, we can see that when the 10-year note yield, the 10-year treasury yield bottomed last year, started basing in the summer and then took off in a strong uptrend, it changed the whole underlying narrative of what was powering this market's higher. I mean, we went from a growth-led stock market or bull market to, you know, a broader-based, cyclical, value-based sort of reopening themed market leadership. And to that point, if you look at where the 10-year note has topped thus far this year, and I'm not saying it's a final top, but back on March 30th of this year, the 10-year note yield hit just under 1.8%, 180. And since that time, the 10-year note has been drifting lower, and obviously today we see it's going, you know, considerably lower, the 10-year and the 30-year. And since March 30th, that whole narrative was changed again. I mean, if you look, since March, banks have been underperforming, value has been underperforming, cyclicals have been underperforming. See, that tells me that at least right now, the street is highly attuned to what is going on in the rate markets. So not only do you have to have a stock market call right now if you're a portfolio manager, you have to have a good handle or a good belief on where you think interest rates are going. In my opinion, I don't believe this reflationary cycle is over. I understand that rates can press lower over the short run. And if we get a bigger correction than stocks, it's my opinion that they certainly will. But I do still think we are in a reflationary expansion cycle. That tells me we're going to continue to see economic expansion, multiple expansion in stocks against a rising rate in rate environment. So in other words, after we go through this period of this pullback and this drift in rates, I believe the reflationary cycle on the 10-year is going to resume itself. And I think eventually, not this year, but maybe next 1-2 years, we're going to see a 10-year closer to about 2.5-3%. The difference with what I'm looking at is, you know, at 2.5-3% on the 10-year, notice what that is. That's not a hyperinflationary spiral in rates. That's not a stagflationary spiral in rates. That's basically reversion to mean. The historical average for the 10-year in this country falls closer to about 3-4%. That means when we were trading at historically low levels around 1%, we're at sort of these extreme levels, very oversold, very extended against the historical average. So to me, reflation is simply mean reversion back to a historical average. 10-year note's going to go from historically low levels, 0 to 1%, back up towards 3%. And against that backdrop, we can continue to see multiple and economic expansion. History's been very clear with the analogs on this one. In the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s period, we saw this exact scenario. After the Great Depression and after World War II, the U.S. entered into a massive secular expansion cycle. It was a big bull market in stocks, and it was right alongside it was a generational low in interest rates, which then proceeded to rise for the next 30, 40 years, I think peaking around 1982. So reflationary bull market cycle, I think, resumes after we figure out what's going on with this current sort of correction consolidation cycle.
You know, you bring up an interesting point when you said that you could see the 10-year Treasury going to 2.5 to 3%. You know, Dan, if we go back just a couple of years ago, I mean, that's where interest rates were on the 10. We were in that 2.50 to 3% range, and the economy was doing just fine.
Yes. To me, the fears that we have completely eclipsed a reflationary expansion cycle, in other words, we're skipping over it, and moving right into a stagflationary contraction cycle, I think that idea is misplaced. I shouldn't say that. It's just too soon. We have allocation for that in our model. We just don't think the timing is there yet. If you look at this country where we are in terms of economic reopen plus our demographic base in the next several years, you have Gen X, you have millennials, the biggest baby boom, and you have Gen Z rising at about 82 million. All these younger groups are going to replace aging baby boomers as productive, consumptive, and investment capacity. So our economy has people power for the next decade to grow. And to your point that I'm not looking for hyperinflationary spiral in rates here. We're simply looking for rates to sort of revert back to their historical average. You can absolutely have those types of growth scenarios in that type of rate environment, which to your point, we did, you know, several years ago.
You know, this brings up in terms of placing money, because as I take a look, I'm in agreement with you that this reflationary cycle isn't over. In fact, I'm even looking at the possibility we may hit triple digit oil. Let's move on to oil for a bit. What's your take there?
I like it. To your point, in the reflationary cycle, we have oil prices moving first towards $75 a barrel. I'm not concerned that we wouldn't hit that. But we also give it latitude to hit as high as maybe 85. Your targets are a bit more aggressive than mine. I'm not saying they're not doable. I'm saying as you know, sort of portfolio managers and what we're trying to stage money here, we're looking for targets first 75 to 85. The global economy is getting back online. There's going to be demand for basic commodities and energy in the years ahead. I think the spike that we saw in commodity prices over the short run. And the best example there is lumber. I believe those spikes are certainly transitory due to all the built-up pressures from the reopen and the lockdown. But over the course of a longer term time frame, I think we're going to have natural reflationary pressures across our industrial commodity complex as we move from recovery mode here in the U.S. to growth mode. And again, a lot of that's based on demographics. So I like oil prices here. I think over the short run, they've become a bit extended. And if you see a de-risking in equities, it'll hit oil as well. You can even see the OIH and the XLE today are getting hit as well. So they're going to get hit with normal de-risking, but they're very much a part of this reflationary expansion mosaic. So oil, we think, is a place you can be, not so much over the short run, but intermediate to longer term basis.
And what about industrials? One of the things that we learned with the pandemic, when you outsource all manufacturing to one country, you start having shortages, whether it's chips or pharmaceuticals or other basic materials.
Well, the beauty about Econ 101, which I learned my freshman year of college, is that as prices rise, given our open framework of an economy here and in most spots around the world, that increase in price is going to induce more suppliers to come online. You're going to see more capacity open up, which in turn is going to pull in a little bit of wage inflation as they require more workers to produce, you know, larger amounts of commodities. But in my opinion, that's going to sort of regulate some of these commodity spikes we've seen. So I like industrials here. I think they're going to be one of the engines that drives this. I think relative to, say, technology, which has a very high multiple at this point, in my opinion, I think portfolio managers, pension funds, big institutional money managers are going to continue to find industrials attractive relative to, you know, some of the other spots to park their cash. So we're in on industrials, we're in on energy, we're in on materials. We're in on banks and financials because, again, I think that rates will resume rising, you know, after we get through this sort of temporary period where the 10-year is drifting lower. But one of the highest correlations we see right now is between what the 10-year note yield does literally every day and how banks perform on a relative basis. It's almost a 0.95 positive correlation, as high as you can get. And that tells me if we're correct on this sort of reflationary call in interest rates, alongside energy, alongside industrials, materials, cyclicals, you want to consider banks and financials as well.
So given this, you still expect this bull market to remain intact. And some key figures here are your 4050 to 4100 on the S&P. Any other things that you would be looking at, Dan, as we close?
Well, look, that's our support level. 4050, 4100 is just a key level. If, you know, that's our line in the sand, that if that's broken, and chances are if that's broken, you're going to see the Dow break about 33,500, 33,500. So watch them sort of in tandem. Then, yeah, we are going to get a bigger air pocket, you know, this year, the second half of the year. That being said, as I believe our reflationary expansion cycle still has more miles to travel here. Our targets for the S&P, not this year, but for the next 1 to 2, possibly 3 years, but could come, you know, a little bit more quickly than 3 years. But we're looking for the S&P to go north of 5,000, basically, in this cycle. We think that, look, if you're going to call a bubble in anything in this market, it's not about Bitcoin, it's not about meme stocks. It's about central bank policy, and not just our central banks, but central banks around the world. They have injected massive, massive amounts of liquidity into the system. Right now, it's sitting idle. A lot of it is in the overnight repo markets. But as they pare down fiscal stimulus, these PPP programs, government subsidies, look, the government's the number one competitor to the bank system for loans right now through their PPP program. As all that stuff starts to wind down, as we move from recovery to growth mode, there's going to be demand on all this liquidity that's been created, and it's going to start flushing through the system. That plus demographics, I think, is going to give us the growth we need. It's not going to be, you know, aggressive growth, but it's going to be steady growth. And I think that's going to allow the market multiple to push higher. So it's that sort of combination of things that's allowing us to remain bullish, even though the short term picture macro wise does look dicey, I will admit. But based on our model, we still have longer term investors. We want them to hold, to stay the course, and keep your eye on the prize, which is S&P 500 at 5,000.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners like to follow the work that you guys do, how can they do so?
Yeah, certainly the best way is to email me directly. It's D Wantrobski, so DWANTROBSKI at Janney.com.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, thanks for joining us. Have yourself a great weekend and a great summer.
Seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today
at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, on the day we're doing this interview, producer prices just came up. They were up 0.8%, up 6.5% year over year. Joining me on the program is Professor Silla. He's a professor emeritus at New York's Stern School of Business. He's also co-author of the book, The History of Interest Rates with Sidney Homer. Professor, I want to go back about not quite this time last year when the 10-year note got down to 0.5%. Today, on the day we're speaking, the 10-year note is up to 1.5%. I don't know if people understand the implications when the interest rate has gone up almost threefold, what that means for bond investors.
Well, it's certainly rising interest rates usually are associated with, for good reasons, lower bond prices. And that actually, that's how we get a higher yield on something like the 10-year note. The price falls enough so that whatever coupon it's promising ends up having the higher yield that the market is giving us. You might say that's a tripling of the interest rate. 50 basis points a year ago, 150 basis points now. Since interest rates are so low, we might think of that as a major move. I would say a movement one way or another of 1% at an interest rate. Historically, you know, it matters, but it was not a big thing. I would say looking at the movement in the last year, it was toward more normal interest rates, but pretty far below normal interest rates. We're still pretty far below normal interest rates, and the Federal Reserve says that's where it wants them to be. The Federal Reserve hasn't really commented on the rise in the market of the yield on the 10-year note. So that's something that they don't seem to be very concerned about.
And let's talk about, we're seeing the inflation numbers the day you and I are speaking. Producer prices are up 0.8%. The Fed's position is that a lot of the inflation that we're seeing right now are transitory. It's the restarting of the economy after COVID-19 shutdowns. But there's others, given the amount of stimulus that the government is using, putting into the economy. I mean, we're actually doing helicopter drops. We're giving people money. There's talk now of a fourth stimulus check that they may be sending this fall. And then the Fed's printing about $120 billion a month. How long can they continue without seeing this reflected in higher inflation, which is, for most of us, is what we're seeing right now in everyday life?
Well, that's what I think we should be concerned about, that the inflation is moving up. You know, it's been predicted for a while. And I myself was thinking that we were in for something like this probably a year ago when the money supply numbers came out. I mean, one of the very first dramatic changes in the statistics, April and May 2020, when the year-over-year money supply data started showing like 20 to 30% increases. These are very large increases in money supply historically. And, you know, I'm old enough now where I remember monetarism and Milton Friedman, and they made some good points, the monetarists did, that when you get large increases in the money supply, it tends to be inflationary. So, but it takes time. Friedman himself talked about long and variable lags for the increases in money to show up in prices. Well, a year ago, we had the big increases in money, and now I think we're beginning to see the uptick in inflation. You mentioned today's producer price index up 0.8% or 6.5% year over year. The most recent consumer price indexes were up, I think, in April 4.1% and in May 5%. So these are, you know, these are not the below 2% Fed target rates of inflation. These are rates well above the Fed's target rate of inflation. So to my mind, we're beginning to see the results of the increases in money and the increases in fiscal stimulus that really began in a big way, I think in March and April of 2020. It's a little over a year later, and we're seeing the effects.
You know what this reminds me of, Professor? It reminds me of the latter years of World War II, for example, 1944, 1945, when we were running massive deficits, as we are doing now. And the Biden administration is talking about a total of nearly $6 trillion of programs that they would want to implement over the next decade. It almost reminds me of an economy on a wartime footing, but we're not at war.
Well, that's right. I mean, people have likened the COVID pandemic to something like a war, except that we're not having a war against the Japanese or the German fascists. We're having a war against the virus, and that's a little bit different. But it did take the wind out of the sails of the economy. That was pretty clear when the government advised us to stay home so we didn't get sick. That led to a decline in the economy. And the government then took that as an occasion to become very loose on fiscal and monetary policies and to revive the economy. It's a pretty legitimate goal, I think. And most Americans would agree that we slipped into a pretty sharp recession as a result of the virus. And they're glad this the government is doing something about it. The question today is did the government do too much about it? And the rising inflation that we're seeing now, transitory or temporary, that's the way you would expect policymakers who caused it to talk about it. You know, it's possible that there's some special factors. You know, one reason the numbers are so high is that they were quite low as we slipped into the recession a year ago. What I'm seeing is that people are making up stories about why we shouldn't worry about inflation, one of which has to do just with the numbers. You know, they moved down a bit last year as we went into recession. So now a year later, they're looking bigger than they might be. But that, to my mind, is kind of an excuse or a way of papering over what I see as a disturbing trend. I'm not so convinced as apparently the markets are and the government is that this is really a transitory thing. I think it may be heating up to become a problem for us in the next couple of years.
Professor, how would you contrast the government's policies today coming out of a brief recession as a result of the shutdowns compared to the financial crisis? Because the Fed was printing money, they were doing QE, but a lot of that money stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed. What I see today is, you know, we're doing helicopter drops. We're actually getting money to people, putting it into the economy. And it reminds me of Milton Friedman's saying about inflation, too much money chasing too few goods.
That's right. Well, I think if anything, the measures taken to fight the pandemic, which maybe it wasn't as serious a setback as the great financial crisis of a dozen years ago, 2007 to 2009, approximately a dozen years ago. I think then the Federal Reserve took dramatic actions of purchasing assets and actually, you know, increasing its balance sheet from less than a trillion up to 4 trillion before it was all over 4.5 trillion, maybe. And interestingly, economists then made predictions like some of them are making now. Some economists predicted that the Fed actions would cause a lot of inflation. What they didn't realize is what you mentioned, that the increases in the Fed's purchases of securities basically caused the banks to hold excess reserves. In fact, you know, incredibly vast excess reserves in the trillions. And I think that's a natural result of a financial crisis. The same thing happened in the Depression of the 1930s. Throughout the rest of the decade of the 1930s, after the bank failures of 1930 to 33, you see the banks in the United States were holding a lot of excess reserves. It's sort of like once bitten, twice shy. They were not so eager to get back into the business of lending then. And I think the same thing was true. The banks took a pretty big hit in the 2007-09 financial crisis. And consequently, they felt pretty good about holding excess reserves. So the Fed's actions and the QEs and the other measures it took didn't show up as a lot more money. But today, the actions the Fed is taking and the government fiscal measures are actually sending money to people. So it's not being held as excess reserves at the banks. It's being put into people's bank accounts. So the money supply is growing now, which didn't happen after the financial crisis. And I think that's the reason why this time we might expect more inflationary effects than we had the last time.
Yeah, and the other thing that strikes me about this is what's happened to the supply chain with COVID. I mean, we have a shortage right now of chips, which is affecting the auto industry. A lot of the manufacturing that was done in China
got disrupted. For example, large ticket items. We're seeing real estate prices up 16% year over year. People are buying big ticket items, RV sales. One RV distributor or maker said that they're booked up all the way to 2022. If you're looking at large ticket items like boats, RVs, cars, all of these big ticket items keep going up, and that's where people are putting a lot of money. So I can't help but think that eventually this is going to show up, and it's going to be at some point, Professor, the market wakes up and says, wait a minute, this may not be transitory. This could be actually real and continue for a lot longer than people expect.
I agree with you 100%. I think we might be closer to that point. And it's not just whether it's transitory or not. It may be transitory, but if the market starts to think it's not transitory, and I think that's the next thing that might happen. We won't know whether it's transitory until a few years from now. But I think the next thing that might happen in this environment where you mentioned the chips and the real estate prices, big ticket items, RV sales, you might even say used cars. Apparently, used cars have taken a big jump. And with the problems of making new cars, used cars have been more in demand and their prices are up a lot too. And don't forget the lumber coming in. Part of the cost of housing is a good part of it. It's lumber, and the lumber prices are, you know, up very steeply from where they were before. So I think there are enough, you know, you'll always see price increases in some sector. When you start to put them into an index, then you see the indexes start moving up. So I'm thinking that so far, people seem to have faith in the Fed, and they give it a lot of credence when it says this is transitory and don't worry about it. But at some point, I see the markets beginning to doubt the Fed. Whether the Fed's right or wrong, the markets at some point will begin to doubt it. We may see some movements up in market interest rates then, and that it doesn't bode well for stock and bond prices, in my view.
So speaking of what the government's doing, our national debt is approaching $30 trillion, and if any of these additional measures go through, it could be even bigger than that. After coming out of World War II, the Fed pursued a policy of financial repression. They kept the interest rates low and hopefully to inflate the debt away, which over time, that debt as a percent of GDP came down. Can they do that this time around?
Well, I think that, you know, you won't ever find a government official either in Congress or the Federal Reserve or the Treasury talking about doing that. But in fact, I worry about it because you know, one of the first things you learn as a student in economics 101 is that inflation is good for debtors and bad for creditors. And the second point to be made there is that the government is the biggest debtor of all. So in a sense, I would say as politicians and government officials, you must have mixed feelings about inflation. You know very well, Janet Yellen knows and Jerome Powell knows and other people know that rising prices do reduce the real burden of the government debt. And I think so we have, after World War II, we inflated away some of our debt, and we inflated away a good bit of our debt in the late 1960s and 1970s. I'm surprised that more people aren't going back to the late 60s and 70s and comparing that situation with now. I think the Wall Street Journal over the weekend did have an article on that, but somebody pointed out that half the American population was born 1980 or later, and so they don't remember the 1970s inflation. And I think that means that they're not so aware right now. You know, we'll hear more about that, I think, from the journalists in coming months as inflation heats up, which I expect to continue. So we need to, you know, educate the younger American population now on how bad things can really get by going back and examining the 1970s.
Yeah, because I'm looking at a screen of Treasury yields, and it's hard to believe, Professor, a one-year Treasury bill has a yield of 5 basis points, a two-year of 16 basis points, less than 0.2%. What would you be telling these investors to do right now, given what you see taking place not only on the inflation front, but monetary policy, fiscal policy? Because a lot of investors have had their money in bond funds. And if you're in a bond fund over the last 12 months, you're losing money. What would you tell investors to do today?
I would say that you should tell them they're losing even more money in real terms, because the the Treasury bill that's paying 5 basis points, or the bond fund that's paying a few more basis points than that, when you take into account the 2% inflation we had before, which is now rising to 4% and 5%, you're really taking it. You're getting a negative return of 4% or 5% since the rates are so low. And I would say that that's a problem. What do you do about it? Well, I mean, I myself have done this, and I've advised people to do it in the past. People should really think about investing in TIPS, I think. If we're due for more inflation, whether it's transitory or permanent, at least the investments in TIPS, you know, Treasury inflation protected securities, will keep up with that. I think the yield on them is in the vicinity of zero now, just like it is in your bank account. But if prices rise 5% over the next year, the government by contractually has to raise the value of your TIPS account by 5%. And so that's a way of, you know, at least keeping up with inflation and not suffering a negative real return by holding assets that aren't inflation protected.
Well, Professor, you have written, I think the last edition to History of Interest Rates was the fourth edition. Have you ever thought of updating that, given the events that we've seen here with, you know, these monster deficits and interest rates at probably the lowest points in history?
Well, that's true. I think the publishers, Wiley, the most recent edition was brought out by John Wiley and Sons. Somebody there contacted me a couple of years ago and said the same thing. You know, would you think about updating the book? And then I said, well, we're in such an unusually low interest rate history, and then perhaps less now than then. I said, you know, if I want to write the history of this era, these extremely low interest rates we've been having ever since the financial crisis of a dozen years ago, I would like to, you know, get the rates back to more normal so we can evaluate what happened and, you know, how we got such low rates and how we came out of it. But so far, you know, the rates haven't normalized. I think there was a trend towards starting to normalize a little bit before the pandemic broke out. But once the pandemic broke out and the recession that had costs started to be a problem for the government, then we saw these dramatic increases in the Federal Reserve balance sheet, up from $4 trillion up to $7 to $8 trillion, and the huge fiscal measures you mentioned before that you know is keeping those interest rates low. So I don't know whether they will normalize. One point I would make, you know, we're concerned about government budget deficits. One of the items of government expenditure is paying interest on the national debt. In fact, I would say it's a very important item of expenditure. And if rates do go up, as inflation goes up, the government will end up having even more deficits than it's projecting, because it'll have to pay a higher interest rate on this, you know, $28 trillion debt that we talked about. You know, people should remember, going back to 1980 and saying people forgot the 1970s, I want to remind our listeners that in 1980, the national debt of the United States hit $1 trillion for the first time. And since 1980, that's the last 40 years, you know, approximately half of my lifetime, we've gone, it took us, you know, from 1776 to 1980, over 200 years to get a national debt of $1 trillion. And in the last 40 years, we've raised that national debt from $1 trillion to $28 trillion. That's something to keep in mind. And a $28 trillion national debt becomes a lot more of the government budget when the interest rates go up, so the government has to pay interest on $28 trillion.
It's amazing. Well, listen, Professor, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. And for our listeners, I'd highly recommend, it's almost considered the Bible on interest rates. It's called The History of Interest Rates by Sidney Homer and Professor Silla, who has joined us today. Thanks so much, and have yourself a great summer. Well, the market is concerned about inflation. There was a Fed meeting hinting that they may be raising interest rates sooner than expected. What is causing all this inflation? Well, let's take a look. Joining us on the program is A. Gary Schilling. He's editor of Insight and author of many best-selling investment books. Gary, in your latest newsletter, you're talking about the honeymoon may be over for the president. He was able to pass his first stimulus, which was $1.9 trillion, which came on top of President Trump's
package of 0.9 trillion. And then he's got two other packages. So you're talking about $6 trillion of stimulus. Let's talk about the impact, if he can get that through, what that might mean for the economy, number one. And number two, is the possibility he will get this through?
Well, if you look at the if you look at the numbers, they would suggest that the entire package would replace people's income in this country pretty much in total. It shows you just the size of it. But I don't think it's going to happen. He's run into a lot of roadblocks. There was, of course, a tremendous concern about the pandemic, and that gave a lot of sympathy for spending, even though it resulted in huge deficits. But now with vaccines, the whole issue is fading. And of course, on top of that, Biden is including in the infrastructure package a lot of income redistribution. That's a main theme of this administration. They feel that income has polarized to the upper end. And the statistics don't show that, as I pointed out in our newsletter, but that doesn't bother Biden and his backers. So this is, they've been really trying to use this legislation, a big part of this infrastructure bill, to redistribute income. Now that is not going anywhere, and a lot of these other programs. So I think what's happened is that the initial sympathy of the country is reflected in Congress to offset the pandemic, that's pretty well hit a peak. And from now on, they're saying, now, wait a minute, do we need all this money? Where's it going to go? There's concern, for example, about people getting money to stay home. Big concern about the extra unemployment benefits at the federal level on top of the state level. It means about 40% of people in this country are better off staying home than they are working, and it's the equivalent of $15 an hour wage. So I think the bloom is off the rose in many senses.
So Gary, if we take a look at some of these proposals, like everybody admits on both sides of the aisle that we need to do something on infrastructure, but of the $2.3 trillion in infrastructure, as you point out in your newsletter, only a small portion of that actually goes to infrastructure. The rest is kind of redistribution. So what's the chance that, I saw there was a committee in the Senate of five Democrats, five Republicans. They've come up with a figure. I think it's $900 billion, billion here, trillion here. But what's the chance we do get an infrastructure bill?
Yeah, well, I think that is coming down to earth. And of course, when you look at it with any perspective, here you've got an evenly divided Congress. It takes a vice president's vote to for the Democrats to prevail in the Senate. They lost seats in the House. They have a very slim majority. You've basically got a divided government. And so the idea that you could have any huge changes is highly unlikely. As I say, I think once the aura of the pandemic wears off, you're really back to pretty much a divided government. And in that case, not much happens unless it's something everybody can agree on. And in the case of infrastructure, yes, there is certainly the need for more roads, airports, water, electric grid, these things. And as you know, Jim, I've been concerned about this for a number of years and wondering why Congress didn't get around to doing anything about it. The argument used to be, how are you going to pay for it? Well, those were back in the days when they worried about deficits. But now with what's called modern monetary theory, since deficits have not increased interest rates, quite the opposite, interest rates have been coming down. I think that's other reasons, but that whole concern has disappeared. So there's no real fiscal limit on infrastructure spending. And it's really a political issue as to whether it extends beyond true infrastructure, roads, bridges, et cetera, et cetera. But that, I think, is an agreement. Now, one thing to remember, though, about infrastructure is that this takes time to put in place. If we look back at the 2009 stimulus bill in reaction to the financial crisis, they talked about having all these shovel-ready projects. Well, it turns out they hadn't even made the shovels, and they probably were going to be made in China anyway. 3 years later, only 30% of that money had been spent. Now, why is that? Well, the money's appropriated at the federal level, but the actual spending is done by states, and they have to get the environmental impact statements. They have to draw up the plans. They have to hire the staff to supervise it, the contracts, and get the contracts let and so on, the bids. It takes a long time for this to come to fruition. So, yes, I think there is going to be infrastructure, but it isn't going to be anything that's going to have much impact on the economy immediately.
Now, let's talk about some of the ways, you know, the Biden administration is proposing raising the corporate tax rate, the individual tax rate, raising capital gains from 23.8 to 43.4. And then you take a look, even making capital gains payable at death. If you're trying to get the economy coming out of a pandemic, you're coming out of a recession, why would you level heavy taxes if you're trying to stimulate the economy?
Well, it's because they see one of their key missions is redistributing income. And the idea is that you tax the rich, their incomes, their assets, and then, of course, you redistribute that money down. They do that a number of ways. They're trying to make it easier for labor unions to organize, organize workers. And after the loss of that union vote of Amazon in Alabama, they obviously are concerned about the shrinking role of organized labor in the economy. So that's one of the ways that they're doing this. But if you notice in all these plans, they'll have a cutoff, 100,000 income, a million in assets, whatever. It's really a soak the rich kind of plan. And I think their basic assumption is, first of all, that they really want that income redistribution. They want to, in effect, punish the wealthy. And secondly, they must assume that they can do so without having any impact on people's willingness to work and invest and to acquire assets and income. And that's, you know, that's an issue that's debated among researchers as to whether people work harder or not if their taxes are higher. But I think their assumption is that it won't make any difference. We can get more taxes. We can basically reduce the wealth and incomes of those on the top without having any detrimental effects on the economy. I think that's a very problematic assumption, but that's implicit in what they're doing.
You know, one of the things we see around here, Gary, is any shopping center you go around, you're seeing help wanted signs. I don't care if it's at McDonald's, Wendy's, or Taco Bell. I mean, they're having a lot of these restaurant owners are having a hard time getting workers because under the unemployment benefits, you can make more money by not working. And who can blame somebody that isn't working? Why would you go work at McDonald's if you could stay home and get more money?
Well, that's absolutely true. But you know, there are two sides of that coin. As a matter of fact, we're working on an article for our July monthly insight report just on that. Because, there's all kinds of help wanted signs. And of course, you've had a lot of people who don't want to work. They're staying home. You point out they're getting paid to stay home, or they're afraid to go out, or they don't have child care as the economy reopens. Kids go back to school and so on, a lot of reasons. But what's interesting is that even though employers are looking for workers, they have done a fantastic job of making do without them. If you look at the data for the first quarter, year over year productivity growth was 4.5%. Now that's way above long-term trend. The best years we had back in the 50s and 60s, 2.5% annual growth in productivity. This is output per hour work, and it's been lousy in recent years, as I'm sure you're aware. But what's happening is, and I think this is what's fascinating, is that employers are really figuring out ways to increase production, even though they don't have the staff they'd like to hire. It's really ingenuity, if you will. And I think probably for a lot of businesses, this was a wake-up call. They realized that doing business the way they had in the past is just no longer relevant, that they needed to address this and producing more without hiring a lot more people. And maybe it's making a virtue out of necessity, but the facts are the productivity growth has been very, very rapid recently.
You know, something else that you bring up in a recent newsletter, and that's the demise of single-family housing. I mean, Gary, here in California, which, you know, our definition of a millionaire is a homeowner, but, I mean, you take a look at, you put a house on the market, it sold over the weekend, people are getting, you know, multiple tens of thousands over asking price, and, you know, nothing stays on the market very long. There's a dearth of inventory right now. You see that ending. Let's talk about that.
Well, I think it's a bubble. Now, let me point out, this is not a bubble of the dimensions of the subprime mortgage bonanza that we had in the early 2000s, and ultimately that's what precipitated the collapse and the financial crisis of 2008. It's nothing like that, because lending standards have been tightened now. You don't have people who are borrowing, you know, not only 100% of an overappraised value on a house, but another 20% so-called for home improvements. In other words, they were back then, they were borrowing 120% or more on an overappraised value of a house. It's nothing like that. So you don't have that, but you still have a bubble. As you're pointing out, you have these bidding wars and this feeding frenzy for housing. And it's been driven by a couple of factors. One is people who want to get out of cramped city apartments with the pandemic. They want more space for a home office for their kids who are home from school. So they wanted to buy single family houses in the suburbs or in rural areas. At the same time, there wasn't a huge supply. A lot of builders went out of business after the subprime mortgage collapse, and those that remained are obviously more cautious. That's what history does. That's what a bloodbath does for the survivors. So you haven't had a huge rebuilding. The estimates are, Fannie Mae estimates that we're 3.8 million houses below where we should be to take care of the demand. National Association of Home Builders, always optimistic on this. Of course, they say 5.5 million, but it's a lot of houses. And of course, this means that you've had low inventories and low mortgage rates have certainly fuel this whole thing. Now, the point is that this is a bubble. Again, it's not like a subprime bubble, but it is showing cracks. We're seeing 3 months of declines in existing home sales. We've seen building permits, which are a forerunner of housing starts, have started to decline. We've seen inventories of existing housing are starting to creep up. And we've also gotten prices to the point that a lot of people are simply being squeezed out of the market. If you look at the National Association of Home Builders Affordability Index, which they put together on the basis of people's income, mortgage rates, and the price of housing, that is moving up. So there's a lot of things that are working against housing, and more people are living at home. If you look at the number of 18 to 34 year olds who are living at home, that's had a huge spike recently. It's gone from about 31% to 34%. So, and mortgage credit availability, that's tightening up. Lenders don't want to go through another round of serious problems. So I think the bloom is off the rose on single family housing. It's been a bonanza, and it probably, like all speculations, is going to have a much bigger crack than most people expect.
That concludes the first half of Jim's interview with Gary Schilling. If you'd like to hear the remainder of this interview, Jim and Gary are going to pick up on FS Insider next week. If you aren't already a subscriber, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button to gain access to all of our premium interviews, airing 3 days every week, airing on our website, financialsense.com, or through a mobile podcast app of your choice to listen on the go. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management Team, We hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.